Hey, sorry.
That's all right. So, by the way, everybody, if you drop out, just sometimes somebody else may be in the middle of something, so I'll just call you back when whoever's done talking is done talking.
Yeah, cool. I have a feeling Craig's in the middle of something.
Are you there, Craig?
Yeah.
What did you hear?
Hey, he's texting his Catherine Webb photos.
That happened while Ben was describing the movie. Welcome to a very special podcast here from filmnerds.com. I am Matt Scalise, and we're trying something new here. We're going to start getting back together again, the old gang, to talk about movies. And since we're all, you know, adults now, and we sort of have our own schedules, I figured it would be fun if we just sort of all forced ourselves to watch a movie that was chosen by one of us and get together and talk about it every once in a while. Sort of like a book club, but with movies. And so our first selection in this series was chosen by Ben Stark. And it is the 1962 Orson Welles adaptation of The Trial. And we're going to, I'm going to let Ben Stark kind of set us up here and explain to us, first of all, why he chose this movie. And because you chose it very quickly, Ben. It was like, I told you that you were going to pick the movie for this, and you almost immediately responded with The Trial, definitely The Trial.
Well, I just wanted to pick the highest grossing film in Bulgaria in 1962.
Right.
No, this is The Trial has been one of my favorite movies ever since I saw it in I don't know if it was in I was in college, and it's a movie that every time I get the chance to watch it, I have to watch it because it's one of those movies that I love, but that I can't. I don't pretend like I know it very well. I don't pretend like I can tell you what it's about or anything, but it just has this kind of lyrical magnetism about it that keeps me coming back to it. So whenever you sent out that notice, I went down my list of kind of my favorite movies, and it's been in and out of my top 10 of all time a couple times, and it's in my top 25 or something now. And as I was going through that list, I realized that, hey, this is a movie that I've never talked to about. I've never talked to anyone about. I wasn't sure if any of you guys had seen it. And it's by one of the three greatest directors of all time, in my opinion, Orson Welles. So I figured, hey, you know, this is probably required viewing.
Is Ben Flanagan on this?
No, he's not. Ben, we should mention really quickly.
He's Ben, scared to watch this movie.
Ben actually injured himself, and that injury prevented him from watching this movie.
I'm sure it's really hard to watch movies when you're laid on the couch.
Does he have two eye patches on? Is that?
I don't know the full extent of the injury. I only got a very basic injury report. So we'll let.
He asked me earlier if he should Redbox The Last Stand, so I think he's fine.
We'll let Ben defend himself on the next podcast here, but I am really curious about just everybody's sort of initial impressions, because I went into this like completely blind. I would like to say that I probably knew that this movie existed in some way, but I knew almost nothing about it at all going into it, which I think was, you know, it made it a fun experience for me. But Graham, like, had you already seen this movie, or was this were you going into this blind like I was?
No, I had not seen this, and I was kind of thankful that Ben picked this one, because I've seen a handful of Orson Welles movies, and I know we'll talk about how this kind of falls into his pantheon later, but I was happy to check this one off the list, and I didn't know what to expect either in terms of production value. I was a little concerned. And really, I hadn't really had much exposure to Perkins outside of Psycho. And, you know, I'll get into it a little bit more in detail later, but I came away very pleasantly surprised from the whole production.
Craig, any prior experience here?
Wells or Kafka?
Well, I guess either one. But did you know anything about this movie, I guess?
Oh, no, nothing. Not until Stark texted his pic or Facebook messaged his pic.
Yeah.
Let's get the documentation right.
Yeah. We need to be precise and thorough.
Right. So, I'll say this. Let's go ahead and start off just talking about what the hell was going on here, because this is honestly, I think what simultaneously appeals to me about this movie and made it a little bit hard for me to watch in a single sitting, because I did break it up, but it was. I mean, this is definitely nightmarish is a term that I think I've read a few critics talking about this film. And certainly that's a word that people use to describe Kafka's work often. But the only thing I can compare watching this movie to is that, having been hospitalized a couple of times, they've given me morphine. And basically what you end up having is these completely illogical kind of like waking dreams. And that was the closest experience I can have to compare to what's going on in this movie. It's very disturbing and off-putting watching the scenes, even where there's not necessarily danger happening. It's just the patter of the conversations is so strange.
Well, at the very beginning of the movie, in his sort of prologue narration, Orson Welles says that his intention with this movie is to create a dreamlike environment. And I think he totally nails it too, Matt. You know, Kay Perkins' character, Joseph Kay, just goes off on all these little tangents and sort of, it feels like he's in this fun house where there's really no rhyme or reason for where he's going or how he ends up where he is or who he runs into. I don't necessarily think that Wells doing the prologue was necessary or really a good idea, you know, but he did it. And I love hearing Wells' voice anytime, but was anybody else rubbed the wrong way by that?
What bothered you about it?
I think he says he's known for being a magician, and I think that magicians, they don't reveal their tricks, and I feel like a filmmaker sometimes should just let the work stand on its own. Now that I'm not referring to him doing the part of the prologue that has to do with that parable or that bit from, I don't know if that's necessarily Kafka's work about the guy.
It's a story from the book.
Okay. So I don't have any problems with that at all. But when Wells is saying, you know, sort of taking you out of it and saying, this is supposed to be a dream. That's,
oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's, okay. Yeah, that's, I can see taking issue with that. Yeah,
but I do. I mean, I agree with Graham in that I feel like it takes you out of it for a second. At the same time, we're talking about 1962 here, and I know that. I mean, it should be. I guess every movie ideally would be timeless in its effect, but I do. I could see Wells or anybody else involved in the production saying, like, maybe we need to, like, cue the audience in a little bit and let them know, like, this is going to be weird. This is not going to be anything like normal life, nor should it be. Is that unnecessary?
Nothing in Wells's work is pretentious in that way, where it could all be argued as kind of challenging, but it's always, he was fond of the audience and he didn't want to alienate people. So I think that was kind of his way to say, you know, get ready. And it kind of telegraphs that first shot too, which is, you know, Anthony Perkins upside down with his eyes closed. So just with that cross dissolved, there would have been the hint that it was a dream, that he was waking up or that he was sleeping and kind of waking up into a dream. But yeah, I can't blame Wells for kind of throwing the audience just a little bit of a life support at the beginning, to hang on to so they could make it through the first, at least, well, I guess the whole movie, really. I mean, it never really lets up on that tone.
So let me kind of throw this out there, because I feel like there's a certain amount of, I guess, early on in this movie, they're wanting to maybe make Anthony Perkins' character, Joseph K, he's certainly sympathetic, but he's definitely a shady dude. You get the sense in this movie that he feels some level of guilt. It's not that he's just completely like hit out of nowhere with what's going on, even though it isn't supposed to make any sense to us or to him. It does seem like he's a little bit, and really throughout the movie, there's various moments where it feels this way, but he's not just entirely just this innocent, nice little guy. Does that ring true for you, Stark, or am I the only one thinking that way?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that opening little light picture show or whatever you want to call it that Wells narrates, I think that kind of gives you the idea. It sets up the conceit that there is some sort of law, and that all of us are kind of hoping to line up with it somehow, or at least afraid of it somehow. And I think that setting it up that way kind of lets us know from the beginning that we don't know exactly what this guy is accused of, but like most kind of Kafka characters, he's guilty of something. He did something wrong. There's a darkness there that I think is just kind of represents just an overall kind of existential angst and existential guilt that, I would say it's from Kafka, but really I'd say a lot of Orson Welles' movies have that too.
I do want to talk about a little more about Anthony Perkins too, because it's really interesting to watch him in this movie. And Craig, you have seen probably more than the rest of us. You've seen, or at least I it seems that way to me. You've seen an awful lot of movies from the 50s and 60s, which is when Perkins would really have been doing a lot of work. I don't know if you have a lot of experience seeing Anthony Perkins in stuff other than Psycho. Have you?
Yeah, actually, I watched a movie called Friendly Persuasion with Anthony Perkins, who plays a Quaker struggling with the idea of fighting in the Civil War. It's an utter bore, and it's way too long. But
it sounds like a really good setup.
Oh, but yeah, he's very, very young in that one. But yeah, that's the only one I believe I've seen of him.
I've seen him outside of Psycho and this. I've seen Anthony Perkins in a movie called Evening Primrose, which is this really weird, dark, like horror musical about a group of people that live in a department store and pretend to be mannequins, and they basically kill people if they get caught in the daytime. I don't remember exactly what was going on. It's very strange though. But he's like,
sounds horrifying.
He has a lovely voice, by the way, in this musical. But and I've seen him in Psycho too, but that's a very different Anthony Perkins by that point in his life. But
Psycho 2, or like you have also seen him in Psycho?
No, as in the sequel to Psycho, which is it's a much darker performance actually than the first Psycho. But
is that where he hits the old lady in the face with a shovel?
Where he hits the old lady in the head with a shovel. One of my favorite just non sequitur clips to throw out there.
Oh yeah, that's a great moment.
Yeah. Graham, have you seen Anthony Perkins in much? And also, what did you think of him in this movie?
No, I haven't. Well, for a little inside baseball, earlier today I sent out the meme, the Jake Ace meme with Anthony Perkins in a still from this movie. Jake Ace being a synonym for jackass, sort of play on words.
Thank you for explaining that, yeah.
Everybody knows what you're talking about.
I actually haven't known this whole time as you guys have been sending me.
And doche means douche.
Yeah, thank you.
So I also broke it up, and so I had to watch the first 45 minutes and run off, take care of some stuff. In the first 45 minutes, I was not sympathetic to him. I did not sympathize with him. I was annoyed by him. And as you said, he obviously had something to hide. And his performance was a little more theatrical than it was than cinematic, I guess you could say.
But that set at the beginning almost feels like kind of a theater set, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, it's an 8-minute take. So it's very much like a, you know,
Is it really? That's an unbroken take. I wasn't even. Yeah. I wouldn't have even realized it.
From the time the guy opens the door to, I think, when he sees the girl, it's all one take.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think that after that opening sequence, the entire movie changes and becomes much more cinematic. And while I think Anthony Perkins is sort of the driving force of that scene, I think Wells takes over after that, after he leaves the apartment. And that's when the movie really, that's when I really started to sort of grab it.
Well, so, I guess that sort of, you talk about that sort of when Wells takes over. And, I mean, to me, there are some spectacular sequences that would have taken a lot of choreography in some cases to pull off. And I guess the first one that comes to my mind is the anything involving the office, as they refer to it. And there's just thousands of people all typing away, and there's at least one moment I can think of where they, you know, in what looks like a pretty long take, if I recall, of dialogue, there's a moment where everybody just all of a sudden on cue gets up and walks away. And I mean, I'm assuming there must be some kind of off-camera cue that we can't see. It's incredibly effective and well done. And really everything around that office set is just kind of, it sort of blows you away with just the scale of it.
I totally agree. I mean, I didn't know what to expect from the production value. And when I saw that first scene when Perkins is running through the office and he's got the box that's wrapped up, I was like, what? I could not believe the scale of this. And I was really just blown away. And honestly, you know, I shouldn't have set my expectations so low because we're talking about Orson Welles, who made Kane and Touch of Evil. But I was really blown away by that. And then the courtroom scene as well. Yeah. And the theater scene, the opera scene for all the extras that he had there.
I was the same way at first. Like, not only did the set look really, really shabby, but almost the production quality was like really off. And then he like walks out. He's following that woman carrying that luggage across this field, and you see this huge building
it's
in the background.
Yeah.
And there's this like ratchet sound as she walks, like she's got like a peg leg or something. I don't know,
but like a leg brace.
It's so bizarre, but it was so awesome.
That was actually probably my favorite sequence in the movie. I can't really explain why. It's so strange watching him continue trying to insist to carry this thing for this hobbled woman, and she just doesn't want anything to do with him at all. She's so angry at him for some reason.
And you get such a good idea of the world in that shot too, where there's that kind of like ugly Soviet block apartment in the background, and then they're walking on just dirt. It's like where are they? It's like almost post-apocalyptic.
Where did they shoot this movie, Stark?
Oh, I should know that. I'm going to say Eastern Europe. I have no idea.
They shot, according to Wells in his documentary, he said they shot a lot of it in France.
Right.
That building, though, that is just an enormous. It's like they're building rockets in there or something. That building is just huge.
What, the office building?
Well, no. When you see, I guess it's supposed to be the apartment building that
the woman's walking. I think that's a matte painting. Like, I think this
is really?
I think this is the third time I've seen it, and I was watching it again today, and I'm pretty sure to get it in frame like they did, I think that's a painting. I don't think that's an actual building.
I was going to say, because in that shot, it is a long tracking shot from laterally, from left to right. And that the building does not move. And I was like, how did that, do they just have are they constantly just slightly panning left as it tracks to keep the building in frame? I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a trick, like where they actually did shoot the building. But I mean,
I think it was a set. I have nothing to confirm that, but I think it is.
Okay. Yeah, I mean it's really well done either way. They sold it to me. I think the other set that's really, but you guys mentioned the courtroom, by the way, and the courtroom is pretty. I guess in and of itself, it's not all that spectacular. It's just that they kind of sneak it up on you, and you're not ready for it when you see it all of a sudden, and it just sort of blasts you in the face as soon as he walks into the room.
And then he's trapped there, and it's like the It's like every dream you've ever had where you walk into like school with no pants on or something like that, where you're just like, oh, there's no turning back.
But he just walks in and this lady's like washing clothes, and then she leads him into this room. I mean, this is the last thing you would expect.
Yeah.
What is she doing washing clothes? I mean,
well, later on she's doing some other chore. She's like the wife of
the guard's wife. Right.
Yeah. Then he walks back into that courtroom and there's like no one there and all the chairs are just like thrown around.
And they're piled up in like 12 feet high. Yeah. It's just this enormous pile of chairs. Yeah. Is that the set that they go back in when he goes and starts flirting with the woman and then her husband walks in and he's like looking down under the bleachers or whatever?
Oh.
Yeah, they start there, I think, and then work their way around.
But I was going to say the other set to me that's really sort of iconic in this is the Advocate's apartment, and it's just because it's pretty darkly lit, and I'm assuming we all watched it on Instant on Netflix, but I mean you can tell that there's just so much detail, there's so much junk going on in that set. It's like 50 years worth of stuff piled up. It must have taken an enormous amount of work to build that set.
Right. And all the mirrors, like every other mirror is busted out.
Right.
And she like walks behind it and that giant pile of books that she's laying on with him.
Well, it's like Orson Welles directs an episode of Hoarders.
Well, speaking of her though, yeah, I had sat down to talk about Romy Schneider, who plays the Advocate's nurse, I guess. Let's start with Graham because he's the only one that's not married on this podcast.
Okay, what do you want? What's your question?
I just want to know what you thought about the is it Lenny? Is that the character's name?
Yeah.
And the performance of Romy Schneider.
Lenny. Okay, I'm trying to remember which one she is.
She's not the woman that lives next door at the beginning.
Right. That's Jean Moreau.
She's the Advocate's nurse.
She's the one he like makes out with on the pile of books.
Oh, she's gorgeous. Gorgeous, man. I mean, there is a trio of beautiful women in this movie. I mean,
and they're all throwing themselves at him.
That's
basically.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, which makes it more dreamlike. But yet it's like, you know, they're throwing themselves at him, and he gets close to going through with it, but something always comes up that interrupts it. It's very much like a nightmare or a dream, you know? That just don't add to it.
Overall, there's this weird kind of skeezy sexuality in the entire film. Like when he walks into the empty courtroom and looks at like one of the law books and it's got like dirty pictures in it.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's a quick shot too, man. That's like less. That's like one frame.
Right, and it's just like overall there's this weird sexual tension and the way that the Advocate uses Lenny and she there's even like she's got a fetish for accused men, and that's just bizarre.
And how the Advocate said that he likes Lenny to tantalize other men and then tell him about it because it amuses him.
And you know Orson Welles this was his actual bed, and he directed the film from his bed.
Well, wait, what did everybody think about Welles' performance in this movie? Because this is some pretty late Orson Welles acting here.
Is every piece of dialogue done in post for him? Is it a voiceover?
Most of the entire movie is done in post. So, like, I think a couple of characters... I think Titorelli, which is another great set with all the boards, kind of the painter up in the tower. I think all of his dialogue, that's Orson Welles. And a couple of other characters, I think some of the arresting officers at the beginning, I think, are Orson Welles. And I read somewhere that I think the first couple of lines that Anthony Perkins gives, they lost them on the set, so Welles had to re-record them himself.
Yeah. There's no telling how accurate this information is on the IMDb trivia page, but according to that, Orson Welles dubbed 11 different characters with his voice.
There you go.
He's like Seth MacFarlane.
Just like Seth MacFarlane.
Yes, yes. They've been compared often by film critics. Well, so I mean, so Graham, I mean, I know you've said before you're a big Welles fan. I know you in one in particular late Orson Welles performance that you're a big fan of, which is his voice work in the Transformers film.
Absolutely.
But what do you think about his performance in this movie?
You know, he's chewing the scenery, and he's just part of the ensemble. So he doesn't really. I thought he was serviceable. But, you know, not one of his greatest performances ever, but he is effective. And, like I said, he just hams it up, and that's fine. That's what, you know, he's part of this kind of funhouse nightmare. And I think that his performance works, especially that in his little monologue about how he likes to hear about his little girlfriend's, experiences.
So Stark, I mean, I don't know how sort of deep you want to go on Orson Welles here, but this is a movie that he has called, I believe he has said this was the best film he ever made in his opinion. I think this was one of his last films that was completed. I don't know. Do you know what else he was able to get done, like, well, in a full form after this?
Yeah. F for Fake was in 1973, and that's definitely a fully formed movie. Mm-hmm. And it's great. But no, it's basically his last kind of complete one. I've never seen The Other Side of the Wind. I'm not sure if that's even available. Chimes at Midnight. I think that's technically a finished film, but it's super hard to get a hold of. I think I ripped a version off of YouTube before it got pulled
down. Chimes at Midnight, by the way, is supposedly he took like five Shakespeare plays, yes, and condensed, yep, them together.
Yes.
That actually sounds pretty interesting considering Welles' history with Shakespeare, but I'm interested. I would like to see what exactly he was going for there.
It's either five times better than one Shakespeare play or five times worse than one Shakespeare play.
I think it's like basically it's all of the sort of the chronicles of the English royalty, like the historical type plays, just all, you know, rung together one after another.
Well, Falstaff is the kind of unifying character, okay, I think.
Interesting.
But yeah, I've never seen it, so I don't know.
Well, but I mean, this is pretty clearly probably one of the last times that Welles was able to get
his full vision out there,
released in theaters, probably.
I would say as an auteurist statement that this is his last narrative film. And then F for Fake is a documentary. So.
All right. Well, I kind of want to open this up and see if something jumped out to anybody else that you guys would like to bring up about this movie or something that just has stuck with you since you watched it. So let me start with Craig.
It sort of like reminded me of Eraserhead.
Yeah.
I kept thinking of that film as I was watching it. But I do want to say, it took me forever to finish the prologue because I was watching this on the iPad and in Starbucks in downtown Franklin, and this old man kept talking to me, and I'd have to pull my earplugs out, and I would just have to rewind it. And on Watch Instantly on the iPad, you can't just rewind it like 2 seconds. You have to rewind it like a minute and a half.
Yeah,
and so,
it's kind of difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. So it took forever. But anyways, yeah, it reminded me like totally of Eraserhead. But it's also interesting, like, knowing all the optical illusions and stuff from Citizen Kane, there's like a ton in this one too.
I didn't really think about other movies that this immediately reminded me of, but now that you say that, the other one that kind of jumps out in my mind is Mulholland Drive, because that's kind of the other time I can remember watching a movie thinking, like, this is really just somebody's nightmare that we're watching.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, definitely.
Graham, any points you wanted to bring up about this movie or stuff that stuck with you?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Craig says it reminded him of Eraserhead because this movie actually reminded me of Eraser.
the railgun in this movie is so bad.
Especially when they play the Vanessa Williams song in the closing credits.
Oh, totally. I mean,
and when when Perkins shoots the alligator in the mouth.
Your luggage.
Yeah, your luggage.
You know, for me, it made me think, man, what if this film, because look, the pacing of the film is sort of slow and languid. I just wonder, you know, if what it would have been like if we would have had the same sort of intensity and pace we would have had that you saw with Citizen Kane. And that's not a fair comparison because they're two different movies. And I think Wells was definitely on his game here. But I just wonder if the editing and the pacing of it could have benefited from a little more intensity, that where you could have kind of used the speed and pacing to sort of pull the rug out from under the audience a little bit more.
Do you think he sort of slowed down as a filmmaker pace-wise as he got older? Because Touch of Evil, which was right before this, is kind of a more deliberately paced movie too.
I think everything, because look, I don't think every movie had to feel like Citizen Kane. You know, even though there are flourishes. But
Amberson's does sort of feel like it.
Yeah, there are flourishes, I was just going to say, of Citizen Kane in Magnificent Ambersons. But, come on, I mean, that is definitely a much more simple and slowed down linear movie. And then The Stranger plays like a Hollywood summer blockbuster, in my opinion. So it's not a fair comparison, but I think that to the casual moviegoer, this movie might feel a little slow. I don't know if you guys agree with me or not in that, but
I mean, I disagree just because I think if it was paced any faster, you're basically every scene is kind of resetting your orientation and,
right,
and becoming more and more confusing. And I think that if you covered more ground quicker, I think it would just, eventually, I think you'd give up on the movie because it's just changing gears so often.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mean in terms of moving from scene to scene. I mean within individual scenes.
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know if I would ever give up those long kind of tracking shots and those kind of wide-angle moving master shots.
No, I agree with you. I mean, honestly, this movie is definitely in the plus column for me. I really enjoyed it. It's not really a fair comparison. I sat there wondering, especially at some parts, early on in the film, I was like, what if the Orson Welles that was as hungry as he was on Citizen Kane was working on this? But I think that he put just as much passion into this movie as he did in Citizen Kane. So this is just coming from somebody that just saw it for the first time. I'm still processing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, for me, Orson Welles is like in my top three favorite directors with Kurosawa and Spielberg. And I'm inclined to say that with almost everything he did, Welles was about 10 years ahead of everybody else. And I think the kind of film grammar and the way that he uses kind of long, moving crane shots for actual dialogue scenes is something that you wouldn't see again until like Jaws or De Palma movies. And I think if you go and watch, I don't know if you guys have seen F for Fake, but that was 73.
That's a very fast-paced movie.
Yeah, the editing in that is 10 years ahead of any MTV editing. So, I mean, if you like the cutting of a Tony Scott or a Michael Bay movie, then F for Fake is, like, right up your alley.
Well,
Stark, that's interesting that you say that, but Lars von Trier is not in your top three directors of all time?
I've never seen any of his movies, so I can't. He might be.
Not really. I
doubt it.
I don't think Stark is really up for watching.
I've just been self-mutilation
very often.
All I know is the Antichrist clips I saw on Mr. Skin. That's.
But I mean, so Stark, a couple of things jumped out to me when you were talking just now. One is you're talking about him being so ahead of his time, and I think one of the things that's funny to me is it reminded me, when you said that, of one of Graham's favorite filmmakers I know, which is Stanley Kubrick, which I feel like this is really kind of in that sort of wheelhouse that Kubrick, I think, now certainly I don't think there's a lot of people that would argue that most of his films are probably not super commercial, and nor is this movie, but I do think that, you know, Kubrick at this point in history was still sort of making a little bit more along the mainstream, you know, Paths of Glory type stuff. And I wonder how influential something like this would have been. So something that's sort of almost non-narrative in this movie, because like you said, Stark, it sort of resets every scene. It's almost like at the start of every scene, like you don't even remember everything that's happened up to that point in the movie.
No, yeah, I can't tell you how the movie flows, and I've seen it at least three times. And so, yeah, I agree with that. I think one thing that I love about the trial is that it falls into kind of this subgenre of existential horror. So like movies like Duel or Knife in the Roman Polanski's first movie, Knife in the Water, or like Don't Look Now. I know Graham's seen that one.
Polanski had another early one that
Repulsion.
That's right. Yeah,
right.
That
I've never
reminds
seen
me
that.
A lot of
yeah.
this too.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So those kind of movies where it's a horror movie, but it's only in tone and in kind of perspective for the lead character. And I think a really good example of that subgenre is Eyes Wide Shut. And really, if you start there and go backwards, every single Stanley Kubrick movie is soaked in this kind of existential kind of malaise and kind of horror. So, yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of The Trial and a lot of Orson Welles in every Stanley Kubrick movie.
What do you think about that, Graham?
I mean, you guys nailed it in terms of two movies that this makes me think of in Eyes Wide Shut and Mulholland Drive. While I was watching it, and this is purely based on aesthetics, a movie that it reminded me of was Brazil. I don't think that there could be a Brazil without those shots in the office.
Great point. Yeah.
So that,
yeah, I agree.
To me, like Ben said, you know, with Wells being so far ahead of his time, that just, and I thought Brazil was unlike anything I'd ever seen visually. And now this has just made me rethink that whole thing.
Yeah, I thought of that too. And as a matter of fact, the scene with what was the painter's name in the weird like wooden Titarelli?
Titarelli.
Yeah, his that scene seemed very like Terry Gilliam-esque to me. Just so like so fast. It was more fast paced in comparison to the other parts of the film.
Right. They had all those cutaways, the little girls looking through the boards.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Stark, I'll let you kind of put the wrap on this thing. I mean, what's your takeaway, I guess, from this? When you think about this movie, you know, I guess sort of iconographically in your head, what is the sort of takeaway? If you were trying to, you know, if we hadn't all agreed to see this movie, no matter what it was that you picked it, how would you sort of describe it to us to try to talk us into seeing it?
Well, it's one of those movies that I think some of us that are those of all of us that watch a ton of movies, every now and then I think we can get into the trap of kind of knowing, seeing the strings, kind of knowing how it's all put together, whether it's from a script perspective or technically, from a cinematography perspective. It's a personal favorite for me because the first time I watched it, I was trying to watch as many Wells movies as I could, and I was watching it on an overnight shift at an industrial shop, and I watched The Trial, and I watched it like once right after, you know, like consecutively, and that's where I actually got the idea for a movie that I made.
I was about to say, this is sounding very familiar.
Yeah, exactly. So that the kind of tone of it is something that seeped into my brain, and I just feel like watching the movie again every couple of months. So it's just become one of those personal favorites for me. It's my favorite Orson Welles movie for that reason. I can't figure it out. Every time I watch it, there's something new about it that I kind of turn over in my mind, or there's a new character dynamic, or there's a new line of dialogue. When I was watching it this last time, I wrote down as many little lines as I could, and looking at it now, I mean, it wouldn't make any sense if I said any of them individually, but they're all loaded. We could record a 3-hour podcast on almost every line of dialogue in this movie, and I've never even read the book. So I think there's something special when a movie comes along that keeps you guessing, that keeps you turning it over, and it doesn't just, you know, lay there after watching it the first time or the second time.
Wow, I can't believe you said this is your favorite Orson Welles movie. That's bold, because, I mean, the guy, obviously you'd think that the go-to would be Kane for any cinephile.
Kane is great, but this is a personal favorite for mine. And wow. I think a lot of the ways that Kane was revolutionary for its time, I think this one was also revolutionary. I mean, I think if you look at the New Hollywood or any of the stuff that the French New Wave was doing around this time or a little bit after, it looks different after the trial. I think Welles had a massive influence. He was kind of the underground guy that nobody wanted to give money to make a movie, but all the filmmakers were influenced by him.
I really like that Ben Stark just let us dig into this. This whole podcast just turned into the making of The Nocturnal Third.
a commentary track.
Just think it up.
What a plug.
Let me say this first.
If you're somewhere on the page,
if you're listening along, and you watch the movie first, and you would like to see a film that was influenced very directly by the trial, Ben Stark, where can they watch The Nocturnal Third?
See, I even hesitated to bring it up because I didn't want it to be shameless. But
I don't care. No, this is filmnerds.com. You're a member. You can shamelessly plug your work.
Just go to thenocturnalthird.com. The whole movie is embedded right there.
There you go. Awesome.
Now paint. Right.
All right. God. That was great. Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks, guys, for joining me for the podcast.
Thank you guys for watching this movie. I'm glad you. I guess everybody enjoyed it, right?
I did, actually. Oh, yeah. I can say I'm glad that you suggested it, and I'm glad I ended up watching it. And so I guess we should go ahead and announce here that Graham has the next pick. So do you have your pick ready, Graham, for what you want us to watch for next month?
I do. I've never seen this movie, so I feel like it has to happen. We might have talked about it before some on the thread, but the next selection will be Steven Spielberg's 1941.
All right, then.
Awesome.
I have not seen it either. Nice. So,
have you guys?
No. I've seen it, yeah. I think you guys are going to love it. I think if you like big, blustery, blockbuster-type movies, it's fantastic.
Well, we'll see, because it's, you know, it seems at face value to be, a lot of people consider it a dud, you know, both commercially and artistically. So
cool to call it a bad movie, but if you're willing to look at it on its own terms, separated from the politics of its day, because I can't deny that it's super irresponsible and way too expensive. But if you watch it like you watch like Bad Boys 2, it could be enjoyable.
Right. I'm always down to watch late Spielberg.
Post 9/11 Spielberg.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we'll see everybody next month, and hopefully we'll have another member of the crew on with us.
Corey.
or Ben Flanagan, provided he does not re-injure himself before the next podcast. So get better, buddy.
Yeah.
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 Aww.
All right.